computer vision, is it cool again?
Now we can take that and then, you know, amplify it across different problems to be solved here.
So is friend.com AI hardware's breakout moment?
We already are so addicted to notifications, and it's one more source of notifications for us.
We're estimating a 30% abandonment of proof of concept AI projects. Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, I don't think it's as pessimistic as it could be.
All this and more on today's episode of Mixer of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and I'm joined today, as I am every Friday, by a world-class panel of technologists, engineers, and more to help make sense of a tidal wave of AI news. Today on the panel, we've got Wagner Santana, staff research scientist and master inventor on the Responsible Tech team, Kate Soule, who's a program director of generative AI research, and Ambi Ganesan, associate partner AI and analytics. So our first segment, we're going to talk about SAM 2. Meta this week announced the release of its next generation of a model it calls Segment Anything. So the Segment Anything model is SAM, and this is the next generation of it. Specifically, what the model does is it allows you to segment imagery or video. So you can select an object and kind of track it over time. Now, I really wanted to cover this because, you know, there's just so much hype around NLP and everybody's talking about chatbots all the time. We should not forget that there's like really, really exciting things happening in other domains of AI and particularly in computer vision. So we're going to start off with a fun question, which is just simply, is computer vision cool again? Kate?
Yes.
Wagner?
Yes.
And Ambi?
Always has been.
Yeah, don't call it a comeback, right? Well, I think with the violent agreement, let's get into this segment. I really wanted to kind of talk about this because, of course, it's another iteration of Meta really kind of playing in the open source game. But I think what's really, really interesting is that it's also a really interesting marker in the ground for what sort of open source exactly means in the AI space. So if you haven't been watching this space very carefully, you know, in the first versions of open source in AI, people said, well, we're going to open up the model and there's going to be weights that are available. And with SAM, they're also uniquely releasing the data behind the model. And so, Ambi, maybe I'll throw it to you as kind of the new panelist. Is I'm curious about how you sort of see this. Like, in the future, is open data going to be a big part of what makes a model sort of truly open source? And kind of talking a little bit about how you think through some of that.
We love open source, right? And open source means different things to different people. It can be just, you know, releasing open data. It could be having open weights, a whole spectrum there, right? I'm really, really excited that Meta went ahead and did this on Apache 2 license. It's fully open weight. There is a lot of computer vision problems that we've been wrangling for several years, right? I remember back in my grad school days, you know, we would go and do traditional image processing and, you know, segmentation through watershed algorithms and, you know, drawing little boxes and things of that nature.
It's very painstaking.
Oh, extremely painstaking and extremely laborious, right? And fast forward to today, it's super, super exciting to see something like this, which can operate at scale on huge videos. And think about this from an enterprise setting, right? My clients... I work with clients that are, you know, they have huge manufacturing operations going on. They have to go, you know, when you think about the supply chain, there is, you know, pallets that need to be moved in the warehouse. There is computer vision that's going on and tracking those objects. Or if you look at, you know, the production settings in a lot of our clients, huge assembly line of objects of different types that need to be tracked through multiple different stages. Or if you look at some of our you know, local governments, for instance, right, one of the things that we've seen is people tend to jump turnstiles, right, when you're going through public transport. And that, surprisingly, is a huge cost to cities and local governments, right? City of New York, for instance, it's a cost of like $750 million. And it becomes a big problem to solve. And in the past, a lot of these have needed to be solved through very specific computer vision models, custom trained for these specific tasks, right? What SAM2 enables is for you to be able to go and rapidly build those computer vision models at scale, because now you can go and do these automatic segmentations of large videos, which means whichever domain, right, you throw in, videos that it hasn't seen before, domains that it hasn't been trained on before, it still is able to go and do those segmentations and track those objects over time, right? And so now this gives us a very, very capable mechanism to go build these domain-specific computer vision models at scale. And so, you know, the short answer, really, really exciting. And that's where I think that open source capability helps. Now we can take that and then, you know, amplify it across different problems to be solved here.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's kind of one of the most interesting things, because I think yet again, this has sort of been a theme in a number of our conversations. You know, Meta in its blog post is like, this is so exciting because you could use it for AR glasses. And I think one of the questions I had was like, is this the technology that finally gets AR glasses to work? And I'm kind of, I don't know, Kate, if you've got opinions on that, or Wagner, you got opinions on that. But there's almost kind of one point of view, which is like again, with AI, like the big application is going to be like turnstile enforcement, right? It actually won't be these kind of consumer elements. But I don't know if anyone wants to speak up for like, no, actually, this is the moment that's really going to make AR glasses work.
I mean, I'm sure this helps us get closer, not farther away. But, you know, I'm always wary of anything that's claimed to be a silver bullet. But I want to get back, Tim, to what you mentioned earlier about like open sourcing the data, because I think it's really interesting to talk about, you know, Meta's strategy and how in Vision they've released the data behind SAM 2, but and the license of the model itself is Apache 2. And you look at the Llama series, and, you know, 3.1 came out just last week, where it's under a specific Llama license, and there is absolutely no data that's released or even described, really, in terms of what was used in yeah.
Well,
fine-grained
detail.
Well,
tell us a little bit more, for our listeners, I think they'd really benefit from, like, hearing. So what is the difference there exactly between kind of Apache and, you know, what's happening with Llama? And I guess why, right? This kind of question is, like, why aren't they consistent?
Yeah, so Apache 2.0 is a very popular, widely used open source license that's been around for years and is considered a very permissible license. Anyone can build on top of it for commercial or other uses without having to worry about further attribution to where things came from. Where Llama, when the models were released, Meta created a Llama license that is custom and bespoke to handle Llama weights. Another big differentiation is Apache 2 is normally used for licensing software. And the data that they released on SAM 2, I think, was CC by SA, which is similar to Apache 2, but commonly used for data. So, you know, there are different terms you want to govern different artifacts, Apache for software, CC by also often for data. And now model weights, people have started to come up with their own licenses because model weights also fit somewhere between software and data. It's a little bit unclear how to the jurisdiction there.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point to end on. And I think if I can, like maybe just to take one more turn at that, because I think it's a really important part of this question. You know, it strikes me that one of the reasons everybody's very excited about open source is the accessibility of the technology, right? This is not going to be something that, you know, a company just kind of put up walls around and then charge you for access to. But it kind of strikes me that like part of the problem of doing open sourcing is that it's also a lot more hard, like difficult to control use, right? Like you suddenly have this technology that kind of anyone can use, and you know some of the people that use it are not going to use it in the most responsible way. And it feels like that's like a really hard challenge, right? Because like I think you know kind of democratizing the technology also creates tensions with how do we like enforce use cases? I'm curious if the panel has any kind of thoughts on that.
Yeah. I think that what open sourcing has been one interesting mitigation for these situations, because as the community notice that there is something going wrong or there is a specific harmful use, then community takes action, and we can look back to open source operational systems, right? They are the most secure ones, right, that we have, because the community automatically or they build on top of this openness, right? And they try to tackle and also mitigate these issues. So I think that in this sense, I think open sourcing is a good strategy to mitigate this issue.
If we're not transparent and open about the technologies that are available or will be available as people continue to work in this area, there's no way for us to build regulations and awareness and proper practices around it. So I'd much rather have this be happening out in the open than, you know, behind some closed doors where we really don't have a good line of sight into what's going on.
That's right. Yeah, I guess this model of like just trust us to like a world where we can actually kind of verify it.
Yeah, I like the verification part.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like, yeah, I mean, once you put it in the open, there's a lot more heads thinking through really tricky problems. And there is a lot more diversity of solutions that come in terms of mitigating these problems, right? Rather than trying to, force and control it. I think when you put it out in the open, you'll have a lot more creative solutions coming to solve these problems.
Okay, for our next segment, I want to cover friend.com. So as you all may know, right, there's been a longstanding dream in the Valley that one of the really exciting things you could do with LLMs is the notion of really, for the first time, creating a fully fledged kind of AI companion assistant. And this dream is kind of manifested in a bunch of hardware projects that have taken place. So the Humane Pin that came out earlier this year is a good example of that. And friend.com is a most recent iteration of that. So Avi Shiffman, an entrepreneur, launched this with a teaser trailer earlier this week. And Avi has taken a lot of criticism online, but I actually want to take this conversation in a slightly different direction, which is that I think, what's really interesting and what's kind of offered by friend.com is sort of the idea that maybe startups can actually start competing in the AI hardware space, and that you could actually in the future launch an AI hardware project and even something so advanced as like an AI hardware companion, just being a small startup on your own, right? That this is not just going to be a kind of space where, the big companies can only play, but that it actually might be a place where startups can play as well. I guess I want to kind of put forward this idea, and Kate, maybe I can pick on you, is do you kind of buy the idea that like the costs of AI are coming down so much that, we're about to kind of be awash in these types of things? Like the idea of someone launching an AI companion product is not going to be like something only, the biggest tech companies in the world can do, but that you'll also have like these upstarts that will be able to kind of like do their own take on this space.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question because we're getting so many kind of, in a way, conflicting signals of what's going on in this space. So, Gartner just released a report yesterday or 2 days ago saying that they expect 30% of all POCs in Gen AI to be never leave the POC phase.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to talk about that later. I think it's going to be the final segment of the episode.
Okay, great. But a lot of what they were talking about is citing the costs, right? So is that we're not seeing the ROI offset the costs enough. And I think that certainly makes sense given what we're seeing. But on the other side, we're seeing models get smaller and smaller and smaller. Like there is this clear trend where we're able to pack more performance in fewer parameters, where we're being able to get to the point where these models can run in CPUs and we don't need the advanced hardware to the same degree that we did a year ago. And, some of these scaling laws are really exciting in terms of how efficient the technology is growing. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think that we could get to a place where startups could actually get into the hardware space for Gen AI type deployments.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of fascinating just because, had you talked to me like 5 years ago, I would have been like, oh, yeah, the future is just like one big company that has all the AI, right? But it kind of feels like we're going to just be awash in intelligence. Like there'll just be models everywhere, particularly with the developments in open source that we were talking about. I don't know if Ambi or Wagner, you've got kind of thoughts on this about just like how accessible this is and how competitive really ultimately a space this is going to be.
Yeah, and definitely agree with Kate there, right? So I think small language models are becoming way more powerful and way more popular for a variety of reasons, right? In the consumer space, like you mentioned, there is a lot of competition in terms of, hey, I'll put something on the edge. It could be a companion type of a device. It could be for, something else that you just want to run on your phone locally. Something that you want to run on a Raspberry Pi device that you're just, tinkering with. There could be a lot of different variations where you're trying to run these models on the edge. Definitely on the consumer side, but we are starting to see some of that on the enterprise side as well, right? Because now enterprises are wondering, can I go and start building really domain-specific models? And, these small language models then come and help them power it through. So if I have data that I don't want to expose at all to the internet, but I still want these capabilities and I have devices in my manufacturing plant where I want, you know, these to be helping my plant workers and things of that nature, then these become a solution, right? So small language models running on edge in local devices, that's definitely becoming popular, both in the consumer space as well as in the enterprise space.
Yeah, and I think thinking about the economics of this, the other thing I wanted to touch on friends.com is, you know, the product is being offered for $99 with no subscription, which is also like very intriguing, like to think about the business model of this. There's always been, I think, an assumption in the AI space, which is, well, the consumers are going to demand, they want better and better and better models over time. But I also kind of think about, like, I had a Tamagotchi as a kid, right? And I built like very deep emotional relations with my Tamagotchi. And it's not like they sent updates over the wire to the Tamagotchi. It was just like a thing that they printed in the factory and it came to me. And I actually wonder whether or not like there'll be almost a similar dynamic in AI. Like we're also, you know, Ambi, to your point, like there's almost assumption that like people will want the higher capacity models over time. But I also kind of think that we may just have like a retro computing movement in AI where people are like, oh yeah, GPT-2, like that's like really where like the peak of LLM creation was. Do you buy that? It's just like my weird take that I've been kind of playing around with is like, actually, it may be possible to do non-subscription AI businesses, because if you have a model that someone really likes interacting with, they actually may not want it to change at all. And yeah, curious if folks have any thoughts on that. Wagner, I'll maybe toss it over to you.
Well, I was reading a few pieces about the friend.com device. And one thing that at least looks interesting is that it says that the context window, well, it's not processing anything beyond the context window. So if you think about small language models, imagine that we could have one being hosted on your mobile phone, then this could be possible. But friend.com nowadays use Claude 3.5, so it's processing elsewhere, right? So it's a device communicating via Bluetooth to your mobile phone. And again, to your point on Tamagotchi, I think that it's a lot different. It's a Tamagotchi, like feeding on people's loneliness. That's the model basically, right? Uh-huh. So that's different because the whole dynamic is different, because before we would have like to take care of the Tamagotchi and that was the relationship, right? And nowadays with this specific device, its application, like it's, again, I'm holding myself because I have so many things to talk about this. But yeah, now that you mentioned about Tamagotchi, it's like the other way around, right? Because we already are so addicted to notifications, and it's one more source of notifications for us, right? And it's based on the usage that, or again, and I've read one really interesting analogy for this is like treating loneliness with this device, like offering as if it was a really friendship, is like giving junk food to someone starving. Like, okay, may help right now, but it's not a solution in the long run, right? So that's, again, to your point, I think that thinking about small language models without transferring the data elsewhere, I think it's an interesting way of thinking, especially for startups creating new technologies. But this specific use, I have so many concerns.
I think the GPT-2 3.5 level capabilities for generic conversation capabilities, right? That I think, sure, you can have a quantized version, and I think you can have the small language models operating to a good degree of just general conversational capabilities. And then you could stop there. But the moment you're trying to get to something specific, right? You're trying to get to something a domain specific, right? You try to have a deeper conversation, then, you know, I think you still need to get to some of the larger models, right? So I think where it'll lead to is that, you know, solutions like this can give you that superficial, shallow conversations. But then the moment you try to go deeper and deeper, maybe, you know, you have to get out of those smaller language models at this point in time, at least.
I don't know. There was something like very satisfying to me to hear that it wasn't going to be subscription. It wasn't going to try and be a large model that had deeper conversation. Like, to me, it's meant it was almost more like a meditative like tool for the near term, but like my dad is not going anywhere. It's not trying to be like a real human, you know, like I really appreciated how much it constrained the scope of the use cases and what this can do by saying like, look, it's a device, we're not going to update it and it's going to be, you know, running locally.
Yeah, for sure. That almost actually is sort of interesting. I mean, I think all these points sort of come together is like oddly, the fact that it is not updated, that does not go to the cloud, like almost presupposes a limitation in how far the relationship can go, right? It's like, Wagner, to your point, maybe it's actually the most ethical way of designing this architecture, right? It's just like an intentionally limited system. We would actually be worried if it was like, we're going to push updates and it's just going to get better and better and better. And you're going to build this like massive parasocial relationship with this thing that's not a real person. I'm going to move us on. So our next story, and KR's already anticipated me a little bit on this, is Gartner, the industry research group, came out with a report this week that estimated that about 30% of Gen AI projects will be abandoned after their initial proof of concept by the end of 2025. And they cite a number of reasons for this, you know, poor data quality, inadequate risk controls, escalating costs, or unclear business value. And this kind of follows on a string of reports in a very similar vein. So just a few weeks ago, we talked about the Goldman Sachs report and the Sequoia report. But for this segment, I think what's pretty interesting, and I think this is the first place I want to start, is 30% all that bad? Like, I was kind of taking a look at that, and I'm like, oh, if we're doing 30%, then, like, for a new technology, we're killing it.
I had the same when I first looked at it, I actually was like, wait, are they saying 30% will succeed or 30% will be abandoned? Because I assumed it would be the inverse, honestly. You know, I buy it. I also don't think it's as pessimistic. Yeah, I don't think it's as pessimistic as it could be. And I think it's valid in that, look, the costs right now, we're in this period where the costs are difficult and we need to have more refined approaches for picking POCs, identifying and understanding the lifetime cost and lifetime value of POCs is going to be really important. But also, you know, like we were talking about earlier, this tech, if you look what it cost to do something a year ago versus what it costs to do something today and the rate that that's changing, you know, I think we're honestly in a fairly optimistic place as we talk about emerging technologies and where Gen AI is headed.
Yeah, this is actually a very powerful argument is almost, if I hear you right, you're sort of saying, even if the benefit of AI stayed fixed, the fact that the costs are dropping so extremely will almost end up justifying the technology. Like it's actually the costs changing versus like the benefits changing over time. Never really thought about it like that. That's really
interesting. Yeah, I have a slightly different take on this. Maybe completely contrary here. So I think when we say Gen AI projects, right, there is a little bit of a confusion and a misinterpretation on what those mean, right? We've realized that when we especially work with enterprises, we realize that the impact is when you do these Gen AI projects, you're trying to solve for specific problems in specific workflows and subtasks, right? So when you look at Gen AI projects and solutions that are going and laser focused solving for specific subtasks, right? Those are being incredibly efficient, we're seeing, right? So I think when we say, you know, hey, 30%, 30% abandonment of Gen AI projects, I think there is probably a little bit of a mixture on what those Gen AI projects mean, right? It could be really broad based things, not necessarily focusing on specific workflows or specific subtasks. So that's kind of how I view it, right? I fully agree that, you know, there is a focus on value that, you know, enterprises definitely look at it and say, you know, when I'm putting in an investment into Gen AI, am I, you know, deriving the value out of it? So 100% on that. But when we say, you know, it's going into a certain set of abandonment rate, I think it depends on, okay, what exactly are you measuring, right? Are you measuring the things where it's going and solving specific subtasks and problems and automating a workflow or things of that nature?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that was actually, I mean, outside of the 30%, I'm giving them a little bit of a hard time on the report. But I think one interesting observation was they were saying look, a lot of the AI benefits are productivity benefits. And that's really hard to necessarily capture in terms of like increased profits. And so there's kind of this interesting breakdown where the technology can legitimately be producing a lot of benefit, but actually just like as a dollars and cents, or in the very least on the bottom line standpoint, like, is it improving my profits? It may be a very hard time to kind of like draw that connection.
Yeah, I think that's where I think those measurements become more important, right? I think as the technology improves and as people start driving a lot of these, I mean, starting to see those, right? One of my clients, now there is a maniacal focus on saying, okay, I'm going to go and see if I'm impacting this particular subtask and subflow. Am I able to go and figure out what metrics I'm going and solving for? And I'm going to monitor those metrics. So those measurements are starting to get put in place. So once those measurements start coming up more and more, then you'll have more visibility into it, right? So I think it's mostly a question of, are you getting the right level of measurements and metrics?
For our final segment, I think one of my favorite things that's going on in the world of large language model evaluations right now is that everybody has their own like kind of weird, you know, folk eval, right? We've got MMLU and all the official benchmarks, but really where most of the action is that when someone sits down and starts talking to a chatbot for the first time, they have their own set of evals that they roll out. One of the ones that's been talked about a lot online is simply asking a model, is the number 9.11 bigger or is the number 9.9 bigger? And it turns out models routinely fail on this. And so for this final section, I kind of want to just do a fun little thing with particularly the experts that we have here today, which is to get their off-the-cuff evals.
I think I do similar evals. I usually test out on like math problems, right? That's a good one. You know, your standard multiplication, addition set of problems. Those are usually a good level of indicator, right? So similar to the 9.11 versus 99, but a different driver.
That's right. But it's like, just to go a little further, it's like basic arithmetic you're asking. You're like, what is this five-digit number plus this five-digit number? Or
yeah, maybe a little more complex, right? Here are like five numbers and then, you know, sort them in a sequence, or, you know, go multiply these and then go figure out what's the response and then sort them, things of that nature, right? So becomes like a math problem that I would give a third grader or a fourth grader.
Yeah, for sure. Wagner, how about you?
There's one that I liked that sometimes reveals a little bit of the bias and cultural bias. It's about describing a breakfast. How does a breakfast look like? So then you usually buy the materials and what the LLM spits out, then you can like have a grasp of what the data is coming from to describe a breakfast.
It's like,
right?
You're looking for like cultural bias, like describe a breakfast.
Is it that bacon and eggs? Or is it that bread with butter? Or is that oatmeal, like something different, right? It's a espresso coffee, or it's a Americano coffee. So that tells a lot about the bias and cultural bias inside the
That's
model.
Awesome. I'm going to start using that one. All right. Well, Kate, round this out. Take us home here.
There's a couple of good ones, none of which I came up with on my own. I mean, the advantage of sitting within research is you get some really creative minds. But a couple of my favorite ones. What type of animal is a chicken? You'd be surprised what the model comes back with. There's a couple around safety that I like to do, you know, asking about, you know, there's two people from different origins, which one's a criminal, and see what the model replies with, just to try and feel out that some of the basic levels. But we've got a long list of type fun things that we like to try along those lines.
Those are great. Yeah, I'd love to talk more about that. I just like as a collectivist kind of like little library of just they're often very funny too. Like people are just like it's a real counterintuitive way at some of these problems. Well, look, Wagner, Kate, Ambi, thank you for joining us today. Ambi, I hope you had a good time. Hopefully you'll join us again at some point in the future. And to all you listeners, thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.